Welcome to Jazz Happens, the podcast discussing jazz in St. Louis from the artist's perspective. Jazz Happens is brought to you by the Young Friends of Jazz St. Louis and Drinks and Jazz at Nancy's, produced by Confluence Studios.
Hi, and welcome to Jazz Happens. I'm Gene Dobbs Bradford, the president and CEO of Jazz St. Louis, guest hosting today. And I have a very special guest and a good friend here with me today. He is a remarkable composer, film scorer, opera composer, six-time Grammy Award winner and Academy Award nominated artist, and he also plays the trumpet. Mr. Terrence Blanchard. Terrence, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Gene.
This is a real treat.
Me too, dude.
You have your hands in so many different things. Not just performing beautiful music, but also your skills as a composer are really renowned. And in this podcast, one of the things that we two of our goals, one is to expose jazz to a broader audience, and the other is to inspire the students in our Jazz U program, in our Jazz Academy program, by telling them about the lives of real musicians who are out there on the road. So I'm really appreciative of you coming out today. And I want to start off by just asking you about a special event that you played with an artist who's not really a jazz artist per se, but but I think she would consider herself just an artist. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Who are you talking about?
Well, I think that might be Lady Gaga.
Yeah. No, it was something, man. I played in Vegas with her a couple of weekends ago, and I met her during the Oscar season. You know, she was nominated as an actor and as a musician. So they put together a dinner for both groups of nominees, and we were there. We hung out. She told me she did a jazz show. Herbie was there, and Herbie started to play the piano. I pulled out my horn, and then I looked up, and she was there, and then she sang with us. She sang three songs with us, and then she said, you know, You think you want to come on and do my show with me? I'm like, I would love to. But, you know, I thought she was just kidding around, you know. But, man, she stayed in touch with my agents. And then next thing you know, I was in Vegas playing with a big band.
Of course, everybody's going to want to know, you know, what she liked to work with.
Oh, she's amazing. First of all, she's a great musician, obviously. But she's a great person, too. You know what I mean? One of the things that I loved is that she was telling all of us that she was the one that fought to have the jazz show in Vegas.
Oh, really?
Vegas didn't want it. They wanted just a pop show. But now here's the irony in all of this. The jazz show makes more money than the pop show.
Well, I think the people who were going, and maybe they have a little bit more money.
See? Yeah, right. Right. So she's trying to do more of that. And she has, man, she has a great big band, you know, great arrangements. Michael Bearden is our musical director. You know, Brian McCollum is playing trumpet and doing a lot of the arrangements. It was really an awesome show.
Fantastic. Well, you're here in St. Louis. You're here in St. Louis with the E Collective. This is a different group than some of the groups that you've worked with before. So tell me a little bit about the E Collective and what inspired it.
Initially, I wanted to put the band together because at that time, it was about 4 years ago, we just kind of felt like a lot of kids were not interested in playing instruments, and I wanted to appeal to a younger crowd but still not water down the music, and come up with some groove-based material. Hopefully that can entice some young kids to play some instruments, because I wanted them to hear some great musicians playing at a high level, you know, but playing groove-based music. But when we started out doing it, man, we were doing our first tour in Europe, and, you know, life was happening here back home. We had all of these shootings of unarmed black men by police, and we just felt like we couldn't let it go. So we kind of centered all of our music around the I Can't Breathe, Black Lives Matter campaign for the first CD. And then the second CD, we just did a live version of a lot of those compositions with a couple of new ones.
Man, I tell you what, it's a beautiful, beautiful ensemble.
Thank you.
And the music has such an infectious groove. It, you know, recalls, I think, there's a Miles Davis album I love, Tutu.
Oh, yeah,
And when you came out, because you have the effects on the trumpet.
Yes.
And it just invokes that, and it's got if you don't mind my saying, it's got like enough New Orleans stank in there that I mean you just can't help like want to move and groove.
Well, that's the whole idea, you know. The whole idea is to try to still get people up on their feet, but with a little different emphasis rhythmically and harmonically.
Mm-hmm. Now, along with performing with the E Collective, you're very well known for film scoring, and mm-hmm. you've scored a lot of films for Spike Lee, but for many others. How did you get into film scoring?
Gene, that's always like the hardest question for me to answer, because I know students are always looking for this one particular path.
Right.
But to me, it's truly the definition of what luck is when preparation meets opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
I studied composition when I was a kid from the time I was 16 years old. And my first piece that I had to write when I was 16 years old was a piano concerto based off of a 6-note tone roll.
Mm-hmm. Well, wait a second. So you're right. I mean, yeah. You're 16 years old,
yes.
and you're studying composition. Yeah. Was that through your school?
No. I was studying privately with a guy named Roger Dickerson. You know, my aunt, who's my mom's mother, always had me in music programs from the time that I was little. When I was 12 years old, my second piano teacher, Miss Louise Winchester, was teaching me theory, mm-hmm. and giving us ear training, you know, from the time that I was 12.
So wow.
I didn't realize that I was a little different from other kids in terms of the intensity of study that I had going on.
Mm-hmm.
But they saw that I was responding. So anyway, I studied composition. While I'm working on my next album, working on a composition, we're also recording the music from one of Spike's films, More Better Blues,
mm-hmm.
for the actors to sing to.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sitting at the piano playing one of the compositions, just trying to work it out.
Right.
And Spike comes by and he goes, "What is that?" I said, "Oh, something I'm working on." He said, "Man, I like it. Can we use it?" And we recorded it just with a cappella trumpet at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then he shot the scene with Denzel. It's the scene on the bridge of Mo' Better Blues when he's up there playing.
Uh-huh.
And Spike later on came and asked me, he says, "You think you could write a string arrangement for it?" Now, for the students out there that are listening, this is one of those moments where do you tell the truth or do you lie? And of course, I lied. I said, "Sure, I can write a string arrangement." But the thing is, I went back and I called Roger Dickerson, who was my composition teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And then he told me, he said, "Trust your training." You know, he didn't give me any specific thing to do. He said, "Just trust your training,"
mm-hmm.
because he's the one who trained me. And I wrote the arrangement, brought it in, had another shock because Spike's dad said, "No, you wrote it, you conduct it."
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So luckily in high school, I took sight singing where we had to, you know, conduct for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew where all of the beats were. So I got up there and I did that. And Spike loved it and said, "You have a future in this business." And then he called me to do Jungle Fever.
Wow. And then, so how many, how many scores have you done?
For Spike?
Or
just
for,
in general? It's about 40.
40. And
yeah.
You just recently did Harriet, which is the movie
yes.
that just came out about the life of Harriet Tubman.
Yes.
Which has a St. Louis connection, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Casey Lemons.
That's right.
Yeah.
St. Louisan.
Yeah.
So hope everybody gets out to see that and enjoy the score.
Mm-hmm.
But once again, I think that, you know, being prepared when the moment comes. And
yeah.
training, because did you ever think that this was going to be something that you might do?
No, I didn't. I didn't even know there was a business
mm-hmm.
for writing film music. When I went to the movies, I always, for some reason, thought it was needle drops. I didn't think anybody actually did that. And then when I found out about it, I found out about it working on Spike's films.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I played on Do the Right Thing,
right.
You know, in school days, and I saw his father writing the music. And I went, "Wow, well, that's kind of interesting." And but the difference is I've always wanted to write for a larger ensemble.
Uh-huh.
I just never saw myself writing for film. But that's the whole thing about being prepared, you know. And this is the thing that I always try to tell my students, too. Practicing on your instrument is just the same as how you practice in terms of how to learn.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get in these situations where you may not be totally prepared, but you have to be accustomed to ascertaining information you know, large amounts of it quickly and deciphering what it all means, you know, to be able to do these things. So I remember when Spike called me, man, I went out and got the Writer Spring. I got a WC piece. You know, I got the scores, and I just started looking through them and listening to the music just to see how certain colors were used in certain parts of those pieces.
You know, I think it's kind of interesting. I think when a lot of students get to college, they're only slightly removed from a time when the only jobs that they knew of were doctor, fireman, and policeman. And for musicians, you know, there are a lot of very talented musicians out there who don't realize how many options there are available to them. Oh. They think either they're going to perform or they're going to teach. But, but you know, there's film scoring, but that also, you know, people are writing music for video games. They're writing music for
all sorts of things.
All sorts of things.
You know, and let me just say this too, you know, and I know this could be controversial, but one of my good friends, he was actually my mentor in the business, in the film business. He passed away. His name was Miles Goodman. Miles Goodman was a great writer. He did all of the string arrangements for my Billie Holiday album, you know. Miles couldn't play the piano. Man, if he sat down, I mean, he was functional, but if he sat down and played the piano, it would be embarrassing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But he knew music. He knew how to orchestrate.
Right.
He knew harmony, theory, and all of that stuff. And the reason why I say that is that sometimes, you know, kids may feel if they don't have the chops to perform live, they don't have any avenues to be in the music business. And that's not true. You know what I mean?
Right.
Miles was a composer. He wasn't a performer. But now, when it came to composition, man, he knew what he was doing.
That's right.
You know what I mean?
That's right.
He made sure that he dotted every I, crossed every T. You know, I mean, he had it together. So there are other options out there for people, you know, in this business. And even on the side, look at what you do.
Right? Oh, I'll tell you what, you know, I didn't really realize when I got to college, I didn't know that I didn't know that arts administration was a thing.
Right, right, exactly. You know,
because if we do our jobs right, nobody knows we exist. Because the only time you would know we exist is when something goes wrong and then you say, hey, who's supposed to be making sure of this? Yes. So and I can remember just hearing the president of Eastman School of Music just talking about what it would take to put on a concert at Carnegie Hall. And I was fascinated by it. And I said, you know what? That's what I want to do.
Right.
And so.
But even with that, man, here's the thing about that, too. Even with that, you still have a large amount of musical acumen to help discern how are you going to make these decisions. How are you going to fit this stuff into a marketplace.
Right.
You know what I mean? And discern what the marketplace is.
That's right.
Yeah.
And now a new thing I think that jazz musicians can do is compose operas, because that seems to be a thing now. You've done two, right?
Yeah. I wonder who I have to thank for that.
Well, for all our listeners.
for all our listeners out there, be careful what you say to people, like, man, because like 20 years later, it'll come back on you. So I'm hanging with this guy here in St. Louis, and we're just having a general conversation about our lives, and I told him that my father loved opera, and I heard opera in the house all the time. Now, I forgot that I told him the story until he brought it back up, because what was it, 20, 30 years later?
Yep, I was sitting in the opera theater, it approached me and said, they wanted to do a jazz opera. At that time, it was a jazz opera, and it grew into an opera in jazz.
Right.
And I knew that you were the right person to do it, and we premiered Champion in 2013.
Yeah, and you know, man, I have to thank you again, because that has opened me up to a world I knew existed. I just didn't know to what extreme. The singers that I've been able to work with here at Opera Theater St. Louis, man, are some of the greatest performers on the planet.
Amazing artists.
And it's been such an illuminating thing. And to have a chance to do a second one after I said I wasn't going to do anymore is so much work. But the thing about it, when you see it come to life, it's crazy. It's crazy how impactful it is.
It was amazing. I can remember, you know, seeing the score at first and then watching the read-throughs and just watching it develop. And then once it came on the stage, and you see how many different, once again, yeah. I think it's, there's so many people involved in yeah. creating
yes.
an opera.
Yes.
And all those people have a role to play, and it's some, and it may be a smaller role,
mm-hmm.
but everything is important.
Oh,
you know, it's like everything, it all works together, and you can't.
Extremely. I mean, down to the wardrobes, mm-hmm. the hairstylists, everything. You know, the interesting thing about it, man, it's one of the first times where I've been in a situation where the music is the thing that inspires everybody. Because mm-hmm. a lot of times when I'm working in film, the film's already done.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's the performances of the actors that really get me going.
Right.
Right. But it's amazing how, for example, with Fire Shut Up In My Bones, those guys heard the music and came up with that set design that just blew me away.
Right, so it's like, it's backwards. It's like, you know, yeah, from
exactly.
film scoring.
Yeah, yeah,
and exactly. I would be remiss if I didn't mention that that's going to be performed at the Met, and it's yeah. going to be the first time in their 36-year history that they've had a piece performed by an African-American composer, which is a shame.
It is.
But thank goodness
yeah.
They're doing it. And it's really, I mean, for me to know that, as I said, I played a small part
you played a big part in putting it together because, you know, they didn't have to come to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? But the way you talked me up to them
yeah.
and brought me in, no, it made a big difference. And the beautiful thing about it all that, the general public should know
mm-hmm.
is how you guys work together to put that thing
together. And that's a beautiful thing. But, you know, the reason why we did it is to have something that would be a part of the repertoire, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Something that would be remembered long after we're mm-hmm. gone. And so even though I'm not a performing musician, even mm-hmm. though I'm not a composer myself,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
you know, because I have the position that I have, I was able to help create something that's going to be a legacy, right?
Yeah.
So I think, once again, there are lots of different options
mm-hmm.
for people who are interested in the music
yes.
industry.
Oh, definitely. I mean, definitely. And that's all still part of being a part of the creative process.
Right.
You know, because it's not like I came in and said, hey, I want to do this opera about this guy and it's going to be the story. No, there were a ton of people involved in trying to pick storylines, story ideas. And mm-hmm. then, you know, once you do that, then you have to kind of sit down and figure out how you're going to tell the story.
Right.
No, so it's man, it's been a great working relationship, you know, because not only, how do I say this? Not only are the people that I've been working with very knowledgeable, but they're unbiased
mm-hmm.
in their judgments about music.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because some people will have this stigma about what opera is.
Right.
You know, and they break all of that down.
Right. And I will tell you that that the operas that you did, it was a beautiful thing here in St. Louis because they were sold out for a world premiere, which mm-hmm. is unusual because that's something that sometimes the audiences will run from. yeah. But also, it brought a beautiful diversity to the opera theater
exactly.
audience that was very refreshing to see.
I was so amazed when it went to the Kennedy Center in D.C. And New Orleans. There's two different stories. The Kennedy Center story was, the guy who reviewed the opera said, I've been reviewing opera for 30 years and I've never seen this much of a diverse audience at the opera. That
mm-hmm.
that made me proud.
Mm-hmm.
In New Orleans, there was an elderly African-American gentleman
mm-hmm.
who came up to me afterwards. He was really excited and he was cute, but he said something to me that hit me kind of hard. He said, if this is opera, I'll come.
All right.
You know, and I thought about it. I'm like, right. We've been celebrating the great operas,
mm-hmm.
you know, but that is part of somebody else's history.
Mm-hmm.
And the cool thing about new opera is that it can bring in audiences because those stories relate to their lives and they can see themselves on stage.
Yeah, it was absolutely fantastic. Now, I want to make sure that I get a chance to talk about the, you know, this trumpet playing that sort of is a big part of what you do.
Yeah.
And this year, we celebrated the 100th anniversary of the birth of one of the legends of this music and one of the most influential musicians out there, and that's definitely. Art Blakey.
Yes, sir.
Who was the drummer who led a band called the Jazz Messengers, which was something of a finishing school for a lot of jazz musicians. And maybe you could talk a little bit about Art Blakey.
I could talk a lot about him. Man, you know, I don't even know where to begin. The thing that I say, if it wasn't for him, man, a lot of us wouldn't be here. Mm-hmm. I mean a ton of us. Mm-hmm. You know, they just recently honored him in New York for his birthday, and they tried to get a bunch of us on stage. Yeah, and you saw how many people were there, and that still wasn't...
And it's like the who's who of jazz,
right. And there was still a ton of people that couldn't make it, mm-hmm. you know? And it was a beautiful thing to be on that stage, but I started to think about this guy. When I first joined the band, you know, the first thing he told me was, forget Freddie, forget Woody, forget Miles, forget Dizzy, forget Clifford. He said, you're here to be you. Now I'm 19 years old, mm-hmm. and somebody's telling me, you know, work at your own craft. At the time, the whole thing about teaching jazz was we had to constantly think about learning from the past.
Right.
And what Art was saying was, no, that's fine, but now it's time for you to work on your own thing. That was extremely liberating from the very first moment I joined the band, mm-hmm. right? Then, after being in that band, he made me reevaluate everything that I was doing, you know, because I could actually see him shape our compositions. Mm-hmm. So then those phrases that he would use meant something totally different to mm-hmm. me when I used to listen to the old messengers.
Right.
You know, I thought they were just random phrases that he would put out there. But no, those things were designed to help shape solos and then help shape the contour of the compositions. Mm-hmm. And that was a hell of a learning experience, you know, being with him. And I tell people all the time, man, I was with him for 4 years, but I aged like I was 40 mm-hmm. musically, you know, because I felt like I was just growing every day. And then I got a chance to meet all of my heroes. I met Dizzy. I met Wayne Shorter. Wow. I met Miles Davis, you know, all playing with Art Blakey. Mm-hmm. You know, and I remember when I met Dizzy, man, he came and played a gig with us, and Art told him, he said, Diz, you know, he plays piano. And then Dizzy said, yeah, okay. He said, well, listen, we were on a break of in between two shows at this festival. And he said, well, look, when we go back out, why don't I play piano for you on the ballad, and then you play piano for me on the ballad?
Whoa.
Yeah, man, I was like 19, 20 years old.
Oh, my gosh.
I told people that was the first time you heard vibrato on a piano. My hands were shaking so much, man.
Art Blakey was really known for always having these young musicians in his band and sort of and mentoring them and teaching them, and that's something that you do now.
It comes directly from him, mm-hmm. directly. Listen, when Donald Harrison, Mulgrew Miller, and myself, we all left this at the same time, and we went down. We were playing a club in New York, and we went downstairs. We were playing Sweet Basil's, and we went downstairs to talk to Art. And we told him we were getting ready to leave. And he said, well, I appreciate everything you guys have done. Mm. You know, he says, but you got to help me replace you because we got to keep this thing moving of developing these jazz musicians.
Right.
And he used to tell us all the time, he said, when you leave the messengers, don't go out and join somebody else's band. Get your own band together, mm-hmm. work on your own music and develop your own sound. And he used to tell us, he said, it's going to be hard, but you got to stick with it. You got to stay out there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, man, he had such great advice for us because, you know, the reason why we left when we did was mm-hmm. he used to tell us, he said, you just don't leave a band. Don't leave a band because you feel like you need to. Mm-hmm. No, he said, listen, if you're working steadily in a mm-hmm. group, if you make a recording and the recording starts to make a little noise, then you leave the band. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. He said, but you just don't leave a band because now you're cutting off all of your visibility. Mm-hmm. Where people were seeing you on a regular basis, play a festival here, play a club here, play a concert there. Then all of a sudden you're not around, mm-hmm. you know? So that's what happened to us. We had done our third record. Mm-hmm. It was our first record for Columbia Records, Donald Harrison and myself. And people were starting to ask us, when are you guys going to go on tour? When are you going to go on tour? And that's when we knew it was time to leave the band.
Wow. And so, you know, I think it's one of these things. You went one time you were telling me about you talking about Art Blakey, talking about Monk, mentoring him, and now you're mentoring these students, and so, you know, it's that continuum, isn't it?
It is, and you don't realize it until one day you look around and you go, none of these kids got a chance to meet Art.
Yeah.
None of these kids got a chance to meet Dizzy,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I feel blessed to have had those opportunities to get to know those guys. And the thing that's so interesting about this continuum is I'm excited for the young people to know who they are.
Right.
Because of the impact they had on my life.
That's right. Well, it's so important. And I have to say that, you know, another bit of inspiration is that mm-hmm. you actually have taken one of our Jazz U students under your wing, and Matt Sewell, who is a guitarist who is going to be a semifinalist, in fact.
I know, I heard,
man. Hancock International Guitar Competition.
Yes, I was so excited.
But, you know, so all those folks who were upstairs working hard and Jazz U, you know, this is real. And you know, I know that it's going to be Matt someday
mm-hmm.
passing it on.
Well, that's the thing, you know, it's the reason why I wrote the tune Soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
It's written for social workers. It's written for people who are out there doing the work with these kids,
mm-hmm.
you know. And Matt Sewell is the perfect example. He's the result of a lot of other people's efforts.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's the beautiful thing about it. You know, because you don't want people to feel like their, you know, their efforts are not, you know, yielding any results, because they are.
Mm-hmm.
Matt is the guy that we see.
Yeah.
But you know how many other kids are out there being productive who may not be playing music, but still, because they were in an environment where they can see a result, as they can see the result of their efforts,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
That carries over into every other thing they do in life. You know what I mean? So for people out there who are doing that work, bravo.
Fantastic. Terrence, I want to thank you so much for sitting down with me today. This
Man,
has been a real treat.
It's been cool, bro. It's been cool.
All right, and we'll hopefully do it again sometime soon.
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you very much. You've been listening to Jazz Happens, and we hope to see you the next time.